How scared am I supposed to be? Much more than usual. This is Movies I Love That No One Talks About. I'm your host, Dan Benamor. Today, we're talking about the 2001 film Joyride. The film stars Paul Walker, Steve Zahn, Lily Sobieski, and Ted Levine as the voice of Rusty Nail. John Dahl directed the film. He also directed previous episodes of the show Red Rock West, and he directed the movie Rounders. Clay Tarver and a guy you might have heard of, J.J. Abrams, wrote the script. The film holds a 74% on Rotten Tomatoes, and it grossed $36 million on a budget of $23 million. Quickly, before we get started, just know we are going to spoil the film. This is your spoiler alert. And if you want to choose an upcoming episode of the show, click on Support This Podcast in the show description and support the show, and we can figure out a movie of your choosing that we both love. My guest today is producer Nick Oleksii. Nick is one of my oldest friends. He discovered the short film that became the 2019 movie Polaroid and the script 1031 that went on to sell to Orion Pictures. Nick, are you the Steve Zahn to my Paul Walker, or am I the Steve Zahn to your Paul Walker?
I'd like to think I'm more Paul Walker, but I also would hate to share his fate. So let me think about that.
I would say you have the looks of Paul Walker, but the personality of Steve Zahn.
I'll definitely take both of that. I'll take it. Thank you. I appreciate that. We're off to a good start.
Nick and I in real life, that's our relationship, basically.
Pretty much.
So we both like this movie so much that we have separately written rip-off screenplays of it. You wrote a script called Movers, which was about black market organ traffickers who use a network of truckers. And I wrote a script called Shot in the Dark, which is about two friends being stalked by another driver on the drive from Vegas to L.A. For anyone who hasn't seen it, the premise of this movie is that some college kids pull a prank on a trucker, so he terrorizes them. Did you know that per the FBI, being a long-haul trucker is the ideal profession for a serial killer?
Wow. I had no idea.
The reason why is because if you kill somebody in Montana, but the next day you're in like Wyoming, the Montana cops are looking for a Montana killer, and the Wyoming cops don't even know to be looking for anything. Mm. It's actually a big hole in like interstate law enforcement. They created a law enforcement program called VCAP, this database to share crimes between states, specifically because of this issue.
Mm. There you go. Makes sense.
So that's why Rusty Nail has never been caught, and they've made three joyrides. The movie actually opens with a shot of a desk with a stack of CDs and a CD player, in case we didn't know this was a 20-year-old movie. And Paul Walker's on the phone with Lily Sobieski. She just broke up with her boyfriend. She doesn't have a car. She needs a ride home. So Paul Walker gets a refund on his plane ticket home and buys a car. Nick, you did this for a girl in college once, right?
This was all I did in college, unfortunately, which is why I'm doing what I'm doing now.
So Paul Walker finds out his brother Steve Zahn was arrested again. He goes to pick him up from jail. Did you know that I actually interviewed Steve Zahn and he lied to me?
Really?
Yeah. I when I was in college, you remember, at University of Maryland, I was a reporter for the newspaper, and I interviewed Steve Zahn about this movie called Strange Wilderness that he was in. And he assured me, he was like, nah, it's really funny. It's like really, really funny. It's really good. That movie is not good. And I love Steve Zahn, but that movie's not good.
I vaguely remember that movie, probably for a reason, which is same thing.
He is one of my favorite actors. He's a great comedic actor. He's a great dramatic actor. If anyone has seen Rescue Dawn with Christian Bale, I mean, he's like Oscar level in that movie as a dramatic actor. This part where he plays the funny sidekick guy is like his bread and butter. He can do it with like one eye closed. He's playing the archetypal brother who is trouble, which is a character we've talked about a lot on this show. He buys a CB radio for the car, essentially for no reason, just for the plot. And then they pull this prank on a trucker where Paul Walker pretends to be a girl flirting with him. And they set him up to meet this fictitious girl in this rude stranger's motel room, which is really mean to this like really lonely trucker. Were you kind of rooting for the homicidal lunatic trucker in the movie?
I think that's kind of obviously the fun of, you know, the conceits, right? They, and you know me, we're good friends. You know, somebody like me, I love pranks. I love nothing more than a good prank. got a good kind of messing with people. And so that's kind of like the dilemma that these guys are in once they see their prank gone wrong really kind of come to light, blood come to light. So I think a lot of it's kind of like, you know, if I'm being on, if, you know, thinking audience, there's like that wish fulfillment of like, what if you could mess with somebody, but what if it now came back to bite you in the butt? And obviously, you know, this is on screen and we're kind of, you know, taking that kind of narrative leap. But I think it's, to answer your question, I did like to see this only because now we're into the movie. We're into like a kind of pure Hitchcock, you know, what's going to happen.
For the audience who doesn't know Nick, Nick is like Don Rickles. Like Nick has pulled pranks on people in the entertainment industry that he sent me that have caused me to like gasp. all right. So Rusty Dale goes thinking he's going to meet this woman, instead meets this like random rude guy, kills. Well, you think he's going to kill him. That's sort of the, it's implied that he killed him. And then later we find out he's just in a coma. But Paul calls the night manager to make sure the guy's okay. Steve goes, you know what's going to happen now, right? The prick's going to kill the night manager. Which is a very meta line. It's basically like JJ stepped out into the screen and kind of winked at us as the audience. And I thought, you know, what's remarkable about this movie, looking back at it, it's almost like a Roger Corman exploitation movie, but then it's directed by John Dahl, who was an incredible director, written by JJ Abrams and Clay Tarver. And Clay would go on to work on Silicon Valley. Ted Levine is the voice of the bad guy. Is this the movie equivalent of going to like a greasy spoon all night diner and like young Wolfgang Puck is the chef in the kitchen?
I think, I don't think that's a bad assessment. You know, I think this is a type of, and you know me, I love a very kind of simple setup. Doesn't need to be super kind of majorly convoluted and twisty turny, but this is that kind of very grounded, you know, at the time, a very kind of simple, you know, almost kind of analog thriller that feels like it's not out of a real kind of realm of possibility, right? And the fact that you have the whole kind of CB communication, there is a high concept to it, right? The cat and mouse, what it kind of, you know, I don't want to get ahead of myself, what it kind of becomes, there's a high concept factor, right? It's kind of like an update on Duel, if you will. So I very much appreciate it, very much love it. It totally works.
I think that the what you're referring to is kind of what comes in the next sequence, which is the cops are there in the morning. They found the rude guy's body. He's in a coma. Paul and Steve eventually come clean to the cops about what happened. The cops scream at them and then let them go. The trucker, Rusty Nail, contacts them looking for the woman. They gave her the CB handle candy cane. Paul Walker admits it was a prank. By the way, like seven different people like DM me or texted me the words candy cane when I said I was doing this in the show. Paul Walker admits it was a prank. Rusty Nail asks them to apologize. Steve Zahn refuses. And Rusty Nail says he should get his taillight fixed. And the second he says that, he can now be any truck on the highway. And I think that's the part when you say high concept is that idea of like, if this happened to you and you're on the road and it's dark and you just, all you know is that he's in a truck. It could be any truck, any of the many trucks that are going to pass you. That's immediately really ratchets up the tension. And then there's this insane sequence where they think it's a guy in an ice truck and it's not actually the guy in the ice truck. And he just gives them like, they forgot their credit card at the gas station or something. And then he goes to leave and Rusty Nail's truck explodes through the ice truck, which is this like massive stunt. How much of a genuine shock on a first viewing is that? Because the movie visually prior to that is very, you know, foot on the ground, very low key.
I mean, that's a type of, I think when you're a writer, that type of just surprise moment in the read. And then as a viewer, that you want to kind of create, you want to put there, you exactly what you said, you have before that, this kind of very tense, he's running from the gas station. He's convinced, we're convinced this guy is on his tail. You know, we're getting into the car with our brother, Steve Zahn, and we've got the guy, and you know, supposedly the killer behind us, and it's a very kind of tense boom, 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 boom. And you know, we're going into the cornfields, and we think, we think we're convinced this guy's gonna get us, and it's just it's a misunderstanding, it's a mishap, it's a credit card, and then all is silent, all is well, we're catching our breath, and then boom, you know, out of nowhere. That's a type of, you know, twist reversal that makes for compelling conflict. that makes for good tension.
So they escape, but it's only because Steve Zahn apologized and Rusty Nail lets them go. They go pick up Lily Sobieski. They meet her roommate, Charlotte. It's like, hey, everything's going to be all right. Let's go out for drinks. You know, there's some love triangle stuff. It's basically like 10 minutes of just calm character scenes. And then Rusty Nail calls Paul Walker and says, I thought there was no girl. And my theory on the movie is that those 10 minutes where nothing really drastic happens, we're just kind of hanging out with the characters, getting to know them. I think that's why the movie is good. And I think it's why it stood the test of time and why a lot of people were excited I was doing it on the show, because it makes us stay emotionally connected to the characters. It basically, we're like halfway through the movie. We just kind of take a pause and just hang out and care about these characters. And then it picks back up again. And I want to just talk about how scary that is to do, you know, for both of us in writing and producing in the middle of the movie, because it goes against a lot of what is drilled into us, which is this fear that if we stop even for a second in a thriller, it's going to become boring. And I think that the reason a lot of thrillers like this become totally preposterous is because they feel like they cannot stop even for a second and they have to keep contorting themselves to keep the tension going. This just takes like a reset.
Yeah, you know, it's also interesting bringing up Lily. That happens right at the midpoint. And I think this is something kind of good to know when you're writing or just kind of developing something like this. It's kind of that constant structural, how do we keep the wheels turning? No pun intended, but how do we keep this engine going without it feeling kind of repetitive? And what you do and what we've already kind of set up, you know, they're on the way to pick her up, and that happens right at the midpoint. And so you are now adding a new character, but you're also upping the stakes. You're very much upping the stakes, and you're very much kind of, to your point, Dan, kind of, again, going back into kind of seemingly calm, seemingly we're going to go through the motions of normal kind of young, early 20s kind of people drama and relationship, as we kind of maybe get the sense Rusty Nail ain't quite disappeared quite yet. That's kind of the very kind of exciting part of you know, this midpoint and you know, knowing that there's some new tension kind of brewing that we're about to, you know, maybe kind of get to.
All right, so we are going to take a quick break for our sponsors. We're going to be right back for the final motel sequence, which is amazing. Stay with us. And P.S., because Nick listens to the show and makes fun of me for this, if you don't hear any sponsor, it's because Anchor basically sporadically pairs shows with sponsors. So sometimes there is no sponsor. And so we might be back in like 3 seconds. So you won't have to wait too long. We'll be right back. Okay, we are back. So Rusty Nail calls again. He's kidnapped Lily's roommate, Charlotte, who, by the way, we met for like 5 seconds and is the emotional stake for the back half of the movie. He says he'll kill her if they go to the cops, and he sends them to the state line parking lot. And then he makes them go to a diner naked. Did you remember this was in the movie that we get Paul Walker and Steve Zahn man ass for like a 5 minute sequence?
Yeah, no, I did. And it does obviously kind of feel very random and like why it, I remember, and I'm, as you know, big into trailers and big into kind of marketing something. That's how you have to think as a writer. And this was a big moment in the movie, right? In the trailer, but also, you know, in the film, in the sense that it's comic relief, right? It's letting air out of this kind of very tense, you know, tightly wound balloon. And, you know, does the movie work without it? Probably, you know, absolutely, definitely. You know, you don't really have this in other maybe thrillers, but I think it's also kind of part of the fun, again, with having fun with the premise, having fun kind of with the characters, and it works. It works just fine.
It's hilarious because as they're going into the diner bare-assed, there's like this very serious foreboding music, like Lily's in the car terrified, and then there's two asses going into a diner. All right, so next, Rusty Nail takes them to a cornfield. He chases them in the big rig through the cornfield. They get separated. He kidnaps Lily. And this got me thinking, you know, a big part of the movie is this idea that they're sort of isolated out on the road and we got to get to a phone. And if you just give these characters cell phones, does the movie just like immediately fall apart?
that's probably a good point. Something I haven't, you know, thought about all too much. Although I, you know, probably nothing, probably something to think about. Probably, you know, and there's a newer type of car road thriller that I mentioned to you recently that runs into exactly this problem, you know, and to your question, to your point, that this new movie wouldn't work. But for its time, 2001, when, you know, this was years before smartphone and any of that, definitely didn't miss it. And it worked for its time, but I would also think it works for today because we're very kind of understanding of, you know, this is two decades old and
right.
It still holds up very much.
So Rusty Nail tells them to meet him at a motel. And this is where we get into the climax. And this is really where Dahl and JJ and Tarver are like bringing their A game. Like we're getting a peek at how good all these people are. Rusty Nail ties Lily up and he rigs this elaborate system of tape so that if they open the door, it's going to pull the trigger on the shotgun and kill her. And she has like tape over her mouth. The room is lit, this like dark red light. And you kind of get the feeling when you're watching it, you're like, maybe they are fucking crazy enough that they're just going to murder Lily Sobieski at the end of this movie. Did you think, I mean, on a first watch, are you sitting there thinking maybe they actually will kill her?
I think the movie has to, the director, John, the filmmakers, they're not doing their job if you don't for seconds or minutes really believe that her life's in jeopardy. Absolutely. In this type of movie, you know, you typically know how the ending, what the tone of the ending is going to be, right? Although a few weeks ago, you had a Mark Pellington thriller, which kind of threw that out the window. Mm. So it's one of those, like, you know, you're watching it unfold, and it's part of the fun isn't the destination, it's the journey. And so very much on this journey, on this kind of trip, yeah, you very much do believe that her life's in jeopardy and that there is a shot, no pun intended, that she can, you know, she could bite the bullet. So yes.
Is it a better movie if she dies?
Is it a better movie? I think that depends on kind of what, again, how you want this type of movie, what your expectations for something like this is. I wouldn't necessarily say so. Are there thrillers where kind of the love interest or somebody kind of perishes and it's a very kind of heartbreaking moment? Yeah, of course. And do they work? I think so. Here, again, it yes, for all its kind of grit and grunge and simplicity, I do think we want, you know, we love these kids, we want them to win. And I think anything other than that, you know, especially given when it came out, might put off audiences. I think I would have, you know, I think I liked it just as is.
I for sure would have killed her. this is one thing I'm learning on myself doing this show is like, we keep talking, we get into situations discussing stuff like this, and it's always like this decision tree of like the slightly darker ending. And my instinct is always to go there. And then my guest is always like, yeah, but isn't that going to like alienate like a good portion of the audience? I'm like, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know if it's necessarily just about alienating, but I take kind of both points. It's maybe you just didn't like your character, you know, in thrillers and some, you know, something like this, the character development isn't necessarily, all too high.
Well, you know what though? I actually think they did a really good job casting her, because one thing that Lily Sobieski radiates as an actress is intelligence, right? When you see her perform, you get a sense there's more under the surface, that she's thoughtful. And in a weird way, it's almost like she is at odds with the movie, because she's filmed in a way that is sort of like a traditional, like she's playing kind of like the sexy girl role. Like there's lots of shots of her in bed, like in her underwear and things like that. But because Lily kind of refuses to play it that way, she kind of elevates it just by her persona. And I think if it was a different actress, there would be the risk that it would play a lot more superficial. So I think she actually plays it well. I think she gets about as much out of that role as you could possibly get. And it is like you said, I mean, it's probably the most underwritten role in the movie.
Yeah, it's also, I don't know if you remember this part, but like the whole towards the end in the third act there with her and Paul Walker's brother, you know, the Steve Zahn character, like whatever they have going on, you know, because then he goes to her room. It is kind of like, it's kind of weird. It's like, are you about to like hook up with this chick who's like your, you know, the love interest of your brother? Like what's happening there? I don't know if you picked up on that.
Yeah, apparently in the research, it said that they had filmed romantic scenes both with Paul Walker and with Steve Zahn, and those scenes were filmed and then cut and not included in the movie. And that's why the movie makes it appear as if she's sort of interested in both brothers romantically.
Which again, I'm kind of just like, why? Like, okay, but like, why is that needed? But like, yes, you know, that is, you asked the diner question, the whole kind of dual romantic, that's kind of like, you can definitely take that out. I guess they're adding more a little kind of like slow building tension. You needed a reason for Paul Walker to be away from her too. But anyway, it is what it is.
So they save Lily, the cops come, they capture what appears to be Rusty Nail, but is actually an accomplice. And he radios them again on the CB radio. So we know he's still alive and he's getting ready for Joyride 2 Dead Ahead. And that's the movie. So I want to just tell the audience, you know, because you know this and I know this, and just how hard it is to make a movie like this, because we both have tried to make a bunch of these contained thrillers that are good, that are well-received, that have a long shelf life, that spawn two sequels, even if they're sort of smaller direct-to-video sequels. I think for both of us, like, tell me if you agree with this. If we made one movie like this in our career that was like literally this movie, the two sequels, the first movie is considered good, has held up, people still talk about it, you kind of have to consider that a successful career.
Yeah, especially somebody, both of us who love thrillers. I love thriller genre more than anything. And absolutely, you know, this was kind of right on the cusp of a lot of the kind of the 2000s thrillers, you know, the Panic Rooms and the Phone Booth, and whether contained or not, this kind of had that kind of intimate feel to a degree, even though it traveled. So yeah, any one of these types of fun, you know, kind of survival, what would you do scenarios, absolutely, I'd be very much proud of course.
What do you think, like, looking back on this now, to Steve is such a fun presence in the movie. And I was looking at his recent things that he's done in his career, and it just, he's been working. It's not like Steve stopped working, but it just seems like he's kind of picked the wrong horse on a bunch of different projects. I can't remember. Do you remember the last thing you saw Steve Zahn in?
No, it's so funny, because as you were saying Steve Zahn, he's almost kind of like a poor man's Sam Rockwell. And I think of like Sam Rockwell.
Brutal burn from you.
Well, they both, I think they have that kind of, you know, Red State, Rust Belt kind of essence, persona. Maybe I'm far off. Maybe that's kind of my progressive side coming out. But no, to answer your question, I don't know. I think Steve Zahn hung it up after Joyride.
I mean, that's for sure not true. Let's just be clear to the audience, 100% that is false.
I don't know. What is something in the last couple of years that he's been in?
You know, it's interesting. I'm actually going to pull it up right now because it is fascinating. Steve, he played, you know, it was almost, what's the guy who does in Lord of the Rings, who does the creature?
Oh, yes. He was Andy.
Andy Serkis.
Andy Serkis. I was thinking Planet of the Apes, which Steve Zahn, I think, is in.
Yeah, so Steve did a Planet of the Apes thing. He is in War for the Planet of the Apes. He's credited as Bad Ape. So, I think he did like an Andy Serkis Planet of the Apes motion capture thing. And then he's in a couple of movies. Like, he's in this movie called Where'd You Go, Bernadette, which is a movie that I think just lost a lot of money.
Right.
They thought was going to be a big movie. He's in Alan Ball's new movie, which is called Uncle Frank, which is on Amazon now. And then he is in The Good Lord Bird, which is a Showtime show. He did this Amazon show called Mad Dogs, which I actually thought was pretty interesting, and he had a fun role in it, but nobody saw that show.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure you made that up, but okay.
So it's one of those things where this sometimes happens with actors. I mean, we had this conversation kind of similarly with Tim Robbins, where it's like, if you kind of pick wrong on like a half dozen movies and TV shows, it's almost like you sort of recede from the public consciousness because just people just haven't widely seen the last couple of things you're in. But everybody knows who Steve Zahn is. I think it's one of those things where he is a guy who his persona that is he's most known for the audience is this sort of like more youthful, playful persona. And now as he's getting a little bit older, he's got a transition. And he's such a great dramatic actor, genuinely, that, you know, I think it's going to be a question of like, somebody's going to give Steve Zahn his drama that breaks through. And, you know, we're going to watch Steve Zahn be a dramatic actor for the, you know, the last 30 years of his career.
Yeah, that sounds about right. I also recall him now seeing this in A Perfect Getaway, which of course, you know, should have been a kind of big, fun, big kind of juicy high concept thriller that I think kind of came and went 10 years ago, 11 years ago.
Did you see that movie?
I did.
That movie has a weird twist.
I saw the twist coming in that one, believe it or not. Not to brag, but yes, it does have a weird twist. But look, to your point, he has been in a lot of things that have come and went, you know, forget National Securities. Sahara should have been yeah. big. Diary of a Wimpy Kid, you know, to kind of your dramatic point, he was in Dallas Buyers Club, but I don't even remember him in there. You have Jared in there. I don't remember him in there at all. So he's capable of kind of being, and that's why I kind of made that snarky thing about Sam Rockwell. He feels like he's right at that kind of, you know, he should be doing kind of these meaty, you know, maybe either anti-hero or just kind of super sidekicky comedic guys. And for whatever reason, he's dropped off. And maybe that's because he's had one too many misses. And
should we write a Steve Zahn, Sam Rockwell movie?
I think we should.
And then immediately burn this podcast just in case they offended. But by the way, we both love those actors. Those are great actors.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
any final thoughts here on Joyride before we wrap up, Nick?
Well, you talked about kind of they shot different scenes for the romantic stuff. I'm sure you then know about like they had different versions of the climax, right? Did you know that?
I did not know that. Enlighten me.
Yeah. On YouTube, so how does it end? I'm trying to imagine remember how it ends, you know, as is in the final cut. It's Paul Walker has to tackle Lily, you know, down before the door opens, right? And that's kind of like
something like that, yeah.
Something to that effect. And a version on YouTube, you can look it up. It's Rusty Nail has tied up, I believe, either Lily or Sam or Steve to the fence, to like the fence post. So now forget the inside of the hotel room. We're now on the outside of the hotel room, and one of them is tied to the fence, and you now have Rusty Nail in this truck that's barreling towards the fence. It's like a bigger climax. And it's one of those things where Paul Walker has to undo one of them. It actually might be where Paul Walker has to undo Steve's. Save Steve first from the fence, and maybe Lily's still in the room. Something to that effect. But it's much bigger kind of thing. So
that sounds cool.
Maybe it was for two, like an extra life saving that they didn't need. Maybe it was like a hat on top of the hat. But it worked kind of as is, and it kind of fits snugly in there too. So who knows?
This movie is so good that even the deleted scenes are good.
Oh, deleted scene was so good. I mean, look, this is that kind of pulpy fun. You know, I'm a big fan of Breakdown. We all love Duel. This type of thing works. This type of thing always works. So very much looking forward to the next kind of iteration.
All right. So that is our show for this week. If you want to keep up with the show, join our Facebook group at Movies I Love That No One Talks About, or follow me on Instagram at Movies I Love That No One Talks About. I want to thank my guest, Nick Oleksii. Until next time, bye-bye.